When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 118 of VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on that podcast app you're using right now so you don't miss a single episode. They come out every Monday and always feature big-name rock stars that found fame in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. Now, today's interview is a really good one, even if I do say so myself. Frankie Sullivan, guitarist and founding member of Survivor. Now, he doesn't do many interviews at all. His PR person reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in hearing his version of events, his side of the story. And I said, well, of course. And that's why it's a really, really long one today. Frankie's got a lot to say, and there's no holding back, no sugarcoating. He says what he wants, and it's nice to hear him get some things off his chest that have clearly been there for many years. Now, a lot of people I speak to are very media savvy in their responses, and you can tell they're cloaked slightly. But Frankie is open and honest, brutally honest at times, and that makes it a compelling interview. Now, Survivor the band are obviously best known for Eye of the Tiger, but their story is deeper than that, with four other top 10 singles in the US, a couple of platinum albums, big tours all over the world. There's interesting band dynamics at play that Frankie will get into, a change of lead singer as well from Dave Bickler to Jimmy Jameson, and Frankie is again very upfront about why it had to happen. As I said, it's a long one, but it's a very, very good one. And a quick mention as well, give VRP Rocks Radio a try, please. An online radio station 24/7 that plays deep cuts and classic hits. There's a lot of songs that you'd never get on the usual classic rock radio, a lot of bands you'd never hear on classic rock radio. There's a lot of forgotten greats that are playing all the time. I've had loads of great feedback so far, so please do check it out if you haven't already. There's a link in the episode description and the description on the podcast as well. Or you can look on VRP Rocks Facebook or Twitter pages, and there's pinned posts at the top telling you how you can listen. Give it a try, you will be very pleasantly surprised, I promise. Now back to Frankie Sullivan then. This is one to get comfy for. We go all over the place with topics. Frankie's happy to talk everything. His appreciation of music and musicians is very, very evident. His love of guitarists is clear on show. He debunks a lot of things we think we know about Survivor. And it's his story. It's his side of the story. It's him telling his side of the story that hasn't been told for many years. It is a rare, extended interview with him, brutally honest and open. Now, there are a lot of swear words in here, so if you're around people that don't need to be hearing cuss words, then perhaps save it for a later time. Or better still, go and grab your headphones pretty quick, because whatever you do, you have to listen to it. And make sure you listen to all of it as well, because we get through so much. So here you go. Please enjoy this chat with Survivor's Frankie Sullivan. Frankie, it's a pleasure to chat with you. I'm looking forward to hearing all your stories. I did watch your interview with the Rocky Files, and that was fantastic. So lots to dissect from that as well. But let's go back to the beginning then, because obviously Survivor started at the end of the 70s. Jim Peterick had come out of Ides of March. He'd had a few hits. So how did you two team up? How did you two get together to form Survivor?
Well, you know, I didn't. Jim's a little older than I am. So the Ides, and by the way, I'm not a big Ides fan, because back then, you have to understand, excuse me, as a guitar player, you know, back then you could be listening to WXL here, my oldest sister who passed away, but she was totally hip, the go-go boots. And she's always had the radio to this awesome station out of Chicago called WXRT. So I would go and sit by the tree because it was cool. It was a battery-powered radio and it had a turntable on it. Of like, I started listening to Cream, and I started listening to Jimi Hendrix, and I started listening to Peter Green, and it kind of segued, but it went backwards, because even at an early, this was before I started playing guitar. Okay. I'm kind of a late bloomer, so I didn't start playing guitar until I was like 15.
All right.
So I started going backwards, like, what are these guys playing? And one day I discovered the most amazing, I think, record ever made on vinyl, B.B. King, Live at the Apollo. It's the holy grail for any guitar player. And then since then, you know, Eric Clapton, well, that's all I ever listened to. So when I went back to the young B.B. King, I said, man, we're trying to do what he does. And, you know, the greatest, like Eric Clapton's one of my, everyone's, but he's really one of my favorites because they call him slow hand and he's not always, you know, new players nowadays are fucking great, but I don't know about pentatonic scales and shit. I don't know what that is, which is probably why John Mayer is my favorite because he could play everything. He could play the hell out of blues. And when I went backwards, I said, these guys, so from B.B. King, you can go backwards. You get to like, you could get to Jimmy Reed. You go back and listen to I'm Jimmy Reed. And then you get to Johnny Guitar Watson. And I figured out, man, we can't do it, but the white guys are really famous, like Eric Clapton, even though he struggled with fame then. I don't think he's that big of a fan of it now, but they were a lot more famous than the originators. So when you listen to the Cream stuff, you listen to like Freddie King, Albert King, you go, B.B. King, you're like, those are B.B. King riffs that we're trying to play. So I went back and studied the origins, and then when I ran into Peter Green, okay, remember Peter from Fleetwood? He kind of was able to do it because it's really, Eric Clapton said in an interview, we can mimic them, we can try, and you could play with a lot of soul, but man, those black guys, man, it's just, so my whole thing is we can't dance like they dance. We can't play guitar like they play guitar. We can't sing like they sing because when I go back to listen like the original version of When You're Down and Out, you know, Clapton covers that song. Nobody knows you when you're down and out. You go back and listen to the original version, it sounds like two guitar players. It's one. They did all this boom, dun, 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 dun. So at an early age, and I think nowadays some of the players, sorry, are a lot more hip to that. But back then, man, that thing was, the black guys were kind of like the best kept secret in the whole guitar world. And then Jimi Hendrix came along. And I think it opened our eyes. And then I think when people started doing, like Eric Clapton at a very young age, well, who's writing? Well, B.B. King. So they started giving a lot of light and shedding a lot of light on the origin of what they play. So that's kind of how I started. But I have to tell you, at the same time, it had Pete Townsend. And like I listened to Bob O'Reilly yesterday. I put it on when I got in the morning. I said, wow, because one of my favorite concerts, I went to see the Who's Next tour.
Oh, wow.
And you know, and we can talk about it later because Ron Nevison did produce those records. Ron's brilliant. And back then on synths, they didn't just go, you had to program every oscillator, every little tweak. And Pete had that big setup. So I'm listening to it going, I go, you know how hard that would be because you have to program everything. So I went to see them live and they had it sequencing. When that breakdown, when he came out and he went around and he hit his knees and slid across the stage and dropped. He goes, hey, you know what a breakdown? I said, whatever that is up there, I got to try to do that. Because I had hair, every goosebump hairs on my body kind of went, wow. And then, of course, I saw Zeppelin 11 times. Because I know, but I was a kid, but I'm like, my friends are always about 4 or 5 years old. Well, come with us on the fourth row. And I'm like, they're doing Since I Love You. Beep, beep, beep. And I'm going, this is on. I realized as a young person, I may never see this again. And sometimes I say, if these younger players could only sit in the fourth row and watch Zeppelin play, because they were sloppy but great. They just fucking were in the moment. So that's kind of where it started. So the Ides of March were like the other end of the spectrum. I'm like, I don't listen to that shit. Not like meaning it shit, but I wasn't into that stuff back then. I was into the other stuff. So I think the Ides, Jim was more into, this is obvious, and he should tell you this, but he probably doesn't. He was more into Blood, Sweat, and Tears. That's where you hear the influence. Like if you listen to Blood, Sweat, and Tears and the Ides, it's basically the same thing. So he had us trying to be like Clapton and Cream and Fleetwood Mac, the old one, when Peter Green. And then he had the other guys who wanted to be like Blood, Sweat, and Tears and the Crying Shames, who are great. The Buckinghams are all great, but they all kind of had that same sound. So they kind of originated from the Blood, Sweat, and Tears thing. And by the way, I'm a huge Beatle fan, but I'm a bigger Rolling Stone fan. The guys that went to the Blood, Sweat, and Tears things, they're only Beatles fans. And I don't know how you can't fucking love the Stones. where I'm from, you got to love the Beatles because of the way they wrote and everything they did. I mean, you have to. Yeah. And it took me a while to like them as much. But the Stones, I'm like, these guys have no patience. It's like, let's go. Keith's playing bass. Charlie Watts on a practice kit. So I split the difference because you got to totally like thought out. And not too anal, because Lennon's pretty radical. He's like, we're fucking done. Did you ever see that video, Getting Better All the Time? Paul's playing the piano. He's going to the piano. He's going, couldn't get much worse. That's where the part originated from. Go find it and watch it. So I think he was from a completely different thing and era. And then I was from this guitar thing. But there's something in that, what I just said, that makes it special. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You get those two guys that are exactly alike. I don't like that. It works probably. I don't really know. But if you get two guys here, and I never can compare us. No one can, Lennon and McCartney. But they're different as night and day. So whatever we did because of those differences, I think, in my humble opinion, was better. Because we're so fucking different.
Yeah.
But you have to embrace that difference. You can't look and say, I had a fucking guy and that. You have to say we're really different, but look at what we do together. The key word is we.
And was that apparent fairly early on when you two got together? Because obviously very different backgrounds. And
oh, you know what? Well, I was playing in a band and they were looking for a guitar player. And they had this fucking amazing Chicago session player. Bruce Geitz was his name. Yeah, I can't play guitar like that. That's not what I'm into. And so they came out to a gig. I was in a band called Mariah. We made a record for United Artists at the time. And they came out to the gig and then they asked me, and they're older guys. I'm like, fuck, man. Gary Smith, killer drummer. Dennis Johnson, one of the best bass players, I swear around. Playing with him made me feel like Jeff Beck, to tell you the truth. He was that good. You want to come and try out for the band? I'm like, well, I don't really get what you cats do, but I went. So it was me and Jim. When we first got together, you know that audition? Not audition. Him and I playing together. We wrote Somewhere in America.
Wow.
The first time. Well, let's see if we fit together. So we spent the first day, and then let's do it again tomorrow, the second day, writing and finishing Somewhere in America. So I said, this is cool. The difference is I was able to notice, and I think it's somewhat visionary, but I'm not fucking a genius, but I was able to notice in that moment, these differences could be our strengths. I still say that because there's a lot of fucking differences, but whatever.
Yeah.
I love the guy, but those differences, I think, made us better. They made us together better. Not better than other people, but they made us better. So fast forward one day down the road, I'm working with this brilliant record producer, engineer, Frank Filippetti. Google him. He's amazing. And he says to me, you know what, man? You know, he's a big 6'4" New York guy, tight, smokes cigars, loud, smart as a whip. Hey, you know what, man? When you get these two guys, they're exactly the same, man. It ain't happened. You two fucking guys, it's so different. That's what makes it work. And I don't care who does what. I said, well, me either. So it's kind of an interesting story, but I think at my early age, because they're 4 or 5 years older than I am, Jimmy. So at an early age, I was able to say, these differences are fucking cool. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if Jim ever got his head wrapped around that, which is the other part of the story. You know, I'm always like, does anybody give a shit who does what and when and where? We both do it together, all of it. So I don't have to be the guy that does everything. Jim likes to be the guy. And I used to tell him, but there is no guy. What do you mean? I said, well, Lennon and McCartney, there's no guy. What do you mean? I said, Jagger, Richards, there's no guy. It's them. So, which probably is another difference that made us work together so well. I think, I always do, but I think you just have to deal with the fact that the differences are what make it sound better between the grooves. Otherwise, it's real generic. You got to have a guy going, man, that's really good. Then you got to have a guy going, the fucking lyric's corny, man. Because you know, we had a tendency to go a little bit corny. I'm like, okay, so we're trying to be clever. That doesn't work. Why? Because the people out there are smart. They know, oh, they're trying. So, you know, I was that guy. Yeah, I don't know. But I liked the differences early on, and I still do.
Wow.
Jim, I don't know. You ask him. You know, he's always... I love man, but I swear to God, he's always got to be the guy. I told him the other day, man, you got to quit. because I'm French, and you know, it's with the Stallone people. You know, when I call him the boss, but his agent calls him the man. When Sly Stallone needs a licensing on Tiger, because I control that, I get it to him for nothing almost. You know, like when he was doing Rocky IV, whatever he did a couple of years ago, and he was trying to get music clearances. I got this text from a long time friend of his, and he goes, you know, the man, the boss, whatever you call him, says, if you don't get this shit straight, he'll use rap music. So he wants it by Tuesday. It was a Wednesday. The next day by Thursday, I got him everything for stupid, like, just take it. I think it was like, I don't know, it was nothing compared to like the amount of money that the movie studios want. So, you know, I don't know. But that's the start of it.
Incredible.
I have a lot to say. That's the problem with me. But I'm telling you, man, it's all true. There's power in the truth, man. It's authenticity. That's the other thing. You listen to Pete Townsend talk, or you listen to Jimmy Page. They're all about, or Mick Ralphs. They're all about being authentic. You know, you listen to a Bad Company record. They made the thing in like 2 weeks, and I'm in the Stones mobile truck, and then can't get enough of you. LeBron says, well, that's the mix from the trailer in the truck. Why? Well, because I couldn't beat it in the studio. And he goes, now, I want to show you something. He plays it for me. What's that? He goes, the cymbal fell over during the mix. So it's number one on the radio, huge. And all I could hear when I hear it now is, psh, when the crash cymbal falls over. But Ron taught me. But if I didn't point that out to you, you'd never know. What's the moral of the story? Just let things go. Because if you go back and try to fix it and tell them to recut it, it's never going to recapture what you got in that moment.
Wow. Fascinating stuff from the beginning there. Just a quick question on the early days as well. John Clodden assigned you up, didn't he? So how did you get to come to his attention?
I'll tell you what, man. And I still am in touch with him periodically. I fucking love the guy. I don't know why he gets any rap that's even like secondary to that. The Scotti brothers, who I love too, they were a record label, you know that. So when we were going to go to Atlantic Records, they were going to sign us, the Greenbergs. And Clodder was the head A&R, so he signed like AC/DC, Genesis. I mean, if you look at his...
Yeah, it's crazy.
This guy's fucking major talent, dude. And he said, you know, I'm going to put you guys on my friend's label, Scotti Brothers. And I'm young. I'm like 21 to 20 at the time. I'm like, whatever. I don't fucking know. So he put us on Scotti Brothers, and he never, ever let go of the reins until we were acting like, well, the band, I hate to include myself, we were acting like a bunch of asses. And then we ended up on our own without Ron. But he always, he just really liked us. And he's a great fan of music and songs and guitar players and singers. But I don't know. I don't have anything bad to say about him. I know I hear guys like Perry or Tyler like, I said, the fucking guy has this. You got to look at it from you do what you do, I do what I do. He does what he does. Well, when you sign AC/DC, the list is forever. You're talented. Because who would have signed AC? Nobody wanted to sign him. Well, I'll sign him. Like Genesis, the original with Peter Gabriel, I'm going to sign him. You should see look at his discography. It's second to none. So we got hooked up with him through the Scotti Brothers. He was really close. It was really good because John's a really cool guy. He's a Jewish guy, long beard. And you got Tony and Ben Sky. They're like, you know, we're going to get together today. Everything's going to be great. You know, two Italian guys. They loved each other. So it was, I think, really great for us on the start, and we should have kept it that way. But fucking bands, man. It could be 80 degrees out, sunny, swimming pools, chicks, hot chicks all over the place, every guitar you ever wanted, every car you wanted, and they're going to get fucking find something to pick on. Well, we kind of fucked it up. But with John, I still stay in touch with him because he's special, not just to me. Well, to me too, but he's special. That's a gift. Mm-hmm. That's a fucking gift. And then you got to go to the head of the label. Maybe they're going, well, I don't want to sign Whitesnake. Like when he went to Geffen, John built Geffen Records. All those acts are his. Well, okay. So they end up selling all, David Geffen sold the company and he made like $2 billion. You know, this is a guy, Clodner, with some really deep talent. So hear and see. That's a whole other thing. But yeah, I love him. That's how we got hooked up with him. I hear from him now and then. He'll hit me up on Instagram, and he's just hysterical. He's hysterical, man. The last picture he sent me was him. And he dresses in all white, right? Everything's white. And he had all these hookers dressed in black leather. He goes, this is my new promo shot. I said, that's fucking perfect. It was perfect because he always liked the hookers. So he has six hookers in black leather miniskirts and him with his white suit on. It's just, I saved it. It's great. A character, a real character, but this is a talented man. You know, that's a hard thing. I wouldn't want that job.
Difficult indeed. And then obviously the band's early career, it built steadily, didn't, over those first couple of records. And Premonition in 81 was big, had a couple of big singles on there, Poor Man's Son and Summer Nights as well. And then you got the call from Hollywood. You've mentioned Sylvester Stallone and Eye of the Tiger and things like that, and it's the one we all know about. So take me back to the beginning of that and how you came to the attention of Sylvester.
Tony Scotti, you know, it's a simple story. I think I said this on a podcast. Maybe it was with Steve. And I said, the fucking story's been, you know, how things get like, I don't know. They get like, all of a sudden, I'm like, where the fuck did that story come from? They get like blown up.
Like Chinese whispers, it changes, yeah.
Everything, you put it this way, everything, 95% of what you heard is complete made up bullshit. Tony Scotti, who was head of Scotti Brothers, was friends with Sylvester Stallone, the two Italian guys in Hollywood. So as a young guy, when I'm going through Scotti Brothers Records, the label, they got all these fucking posters of Sylvester Stallone. I'm like, what? Autograph. I'm like, the fuck are these up here for? Well, they're really good friends. So they were out to dinner one night at Rayo. That's this Italian restaurant here. And this is true, too. The movie was done. Sly Stallone wanted different music, and he didn't want to put the fucking movie out. So Tony's a smart guy. He's real smart. He's like, well, you know, I could, he didn't say it, but this is my take. I could use the help too. That's if you want to read between the lines. I have this band. They're really fucking good. And I think these two guys are good writers. Why don't you let them see what they could do? That's it. The rest of it's bullshit. It's all phenomenalized bullshit. The phone, I have to read this stuff. The call that rocked the world. There's no fucking call. It's all bullshit. He called one person, me. Okay. And it lasted like about 30 seconds. And then as time went on, you know, we would have to talk with him stuff. But when I listen to, that's why I said I don't want to do interviews. When I listen to some of the stuff, it's bullshit. There's always a real person involved who should get, like the Scotti Brothers. Like one day I got a call from them. Well, it's about time. And this was like maybe 2 years ago. It's 50,000 years later. What? Well, where do I? They should get credit. Like Tony, for that moment, being out to dinner with his friend, who happens to be the biggest movie star in the world, going, no, man, I don't like the music. Well, I got this band. That he should get big credit for that, because without the Italian food, that rest setting, being friends with Sly Stallone, it's all out the window. And nobody fucking knows that. I'm like, Jim, why don't you just tell him, man, Tony and Sly were and are friends, and that's it. The rest of it is bullshit. Because I have to read it. I just stopped. I said, it's a lie. It's a fucking lie. It's a flat out lie. None of it happened. And I'm like, I used to take, not heat, but I used to just say, just leave things be. And then one day, I think the man said to me, you know, some of those stories, I said, I know. I get embarrassed real easy. I know, man. And so I said, yeah, I'll just start telling the truth. What the fuck? How are you going to go wrong? I said, but, you know, I don't ever want to look like there's a rip between me and Jim, because Jim likes riffs, but he knows better, but he likes to project. I hate them and they don't exist. So one day I decided, fuck it, I'll just tell a story. It's just the truth. It's true. So it's pretty simple. But, you know, it's being in the right place at the right time for everybody. Yeah. Tony's fucking genius, man. He's still out there making deals. Don't forget he owns Baywatch, and he's big. So, you know, in that moment, he's like, well, here. And that's, which is what I would do. It's amazing, is it? Now you hear about the rock, that call it rock the world. It never fucking existed. Guy call up, yo, you know, Tony told me to call you guys. Yeah. I mean, what are you going to say on the phone to Sly Stallone when you're like 22? He just listens to you, go, okay, so we'll try to, yeah, put some song together. And you send in a tape, and how the fuck do you know? You don't. So that's what we did. And Tiger was the first song, by the way. We wrote two, okay? Tiger was the first song. It took us 10 minutes, except for the lyrics. The lyrics took us, because we didn't have watching us all with the eye through the, we didn't have that one fucking line.
Okay.
All the other, the writing in the song was basically done in 10 minutes, except for the hook line, which is the most important line. But man, it was a hard 2 or 3 days. And then one day it just dawned on both of us. Wait a minute. We didn't even think about the movie making connections. We just came up with the tagline. We called it The Eye of the Tiger, but we didn't know how to end the chorus. I'm like, man, Jim, we must suck as songwriters. We got to come up with like a great tagline. And we're sitting around there watching us all with, you know, then we got to analyze where we're through, whatever, watching us all blank with the eye through the eye of the tiger. That's how it came up. And when we sent it in, we wrote another ballad called Ever Since the War Began, which Sly Stallone ended up using at the end of Lockup. And he had Jimmy sing it. What a fucking voice. Jimmy Jameson sang it. And it was just fucking great. So he said to me, hey, I like the first song, which is Tiger. And we were like, ah, that's just movie music to us. We were doing a demo. And he goes, and the second song, I want to put a hold on. I'm like, well, how the fuck you put a hold on a song? You know, because you're thinking at the top of your head. Yeah, yeah, whatever, whatever. And then, you know, we got word that he wanted to use it. And then we did, by the way, the version in the movie is not the version on the record. You know that, right?
Yep.
The version in the movie is a fucking demo that they all cried about. I'm like, if we don't get it in, everybody, and this isn't going to last forever, you know, I should say that it's going to move on. And this guy's fast. What do you mean? I said, he's smart. He's rewriting scenes and stuff. We don't get this in, we're going to miss it. And Sly's like, what the fuck is a demo, man? He said to me one day, go, man, what's the matter? I said, oh, fuck the guys, man. What, demo? The fuck is a demo? So I said, yeah, like Pete Townshend would say, ram, jam, jam. What's a demo? So I said, well, we'll use the demo. So the version in the movie is actually the demo. I still have the cassette tape. It says Rocky III demo on it. I still have it because I said, this is hysterical. I still have it. It's hysterical because we got to re-record. I'm like, we got a fucking time. We're going to miss the whole window. The whole thing just go out the window. So, and, you know, Sly was attached to it anyhow. So why not just roll with it?
Yeah.
I actually like the difference. I know what the difference is. More bass. It's got a little bit more boom. You know, when you hear, oh, let's record it for, let's do it for real. I don't know what that meant. Okay. But in the meantime, you lose all that. You're doing a demo. You lose all that. Yeah. You're just moving faders and then boom. Yeah. And you print and it comes together and you can't ever recreate that. So I had more bass and more kick drum that boom, boom. Listen to his kicking and he fucking loved it. He goes, I don't even want to hear anything else. I said, well, then that answers that question. Yeah. So that was it.
Fantastic stuff.
The rest was like history. The rest, well, it's true. The rest was like history because you're like going, oh, he's going to use it. It's funny. Then you go to the movie theater. Let me go see the movie. It's like, on the way there, through three radio station, XRT, WLS, and no, XRT, I forget, the Loop, one other station. I'm switching, and all three of the stations are playing a song. I'm like, hey, maybe this is going to be a hit record, the beauty of youth. So I get to the movie, and they start going, and the people start cheering when Tiger starts. And then at the end, the fucking people stand up and applaud. I go, oh, they must really like the movie. You know what I'm saying? I was kind of kidding around tongue-in-cheek, but that's another thing. You know, people should feel like we're all blessed, but you have to be grateful. But you work hard. Yeah. We all do. You, me, no matter what we do, we work hard. People should feel like, wow. I think we should always remember that word. My grandson, wow. Okay, that's how I am sometimes. Wow. You know, it's a big thing. And, you know, it all came out of a relationship between two guys out to dinner. One of the biggest movie star in Hollywood ever. And one half with the music, and then we get Tiger in on three stations, and people stand up and clap. And the rest of it from there was just a great big, one great ride without any downs. It was just,
And just in terms of the movie itself, when you're watching that, did you get like goosebumps or the hair standing up on the back of your neck when you saw how beautifully the music matched and they made it match everything that was going on in the scene?
That's another thing. Sly Stallone is really smart. So he liked it so much that he went and he recut some of that montage to match, because this is another story. Queen was in there. Was another one, Bites Us, and then I'll tell you later. So when he got Tiger, he liked it so much, so he kind of recut to the rhythm of the song. He added a few scenes. You know, hi, it's the Muppet Show. All the stuff he did on there. He's a fucking great filmmaker. He doesn't even get the credit, but he's a really good filmmaker. So doing that made the song even better for the movie, but you got to give him the song so he could make it better. So I think it was like one hand washes the other, but he did a great job with it. Fucking did a great job. Then you fast forward, we're playing at the Forum, and my guitar tech goes, hey, you know, Brian May wants to meet you. Brian May, because he's one of my fucking idols. I love, does anybody not like Brian May? Nicest guy in the world. A total gentleman. I'm like, wow, I'm like free. I go to meet him. He's like, totally Brian May. And chill out. He goes, we're talking. He goes, so was our song in there? Yeah, it was in there, Brian. Yeah, another one. That's what I heard. I said, no, I have a cut, but I can't give it to you because I don't know if the man would get mad at me, but. Which I still have. I have the original. I have the first 10 minutes because Sly sent the first 10 minutes and I had to call him up. I'm like, hey, dude, what? It's not like we're going to make bootleg copies in the fucking garage. We want to see the whole movie. I did, as I said to him. So maybe that was like when we first hooked up. And then he sent the whole movie, but it had another one, Bites the Dust, in it. So I have a copy of the first 10 minutes with nothing. Then I have a finished copy with another one, Bites the Dust, and then I have Tiger. And say with the original script of Rocky III, with Sly changing scenes and notes, it's in a safety deposit box. Because I think somewhere along the line, somebody told me, I don't think that the man ever wants to see that shit for sale on eBay. I'm like, well, I wouldn't do that anyhow, but it's probably worth a fortune, but I don't look at things that way. I know his original script, some guy owns it. I know it pisses him off. If I was the guy, I would just give it back to him. He has this red notebook where he handwrites. He wrote the whole Rocky thing out, and some billionaire owns it. I would just give the fucking thing back to him. Mm-hmm. And he says, that's not the way the thing world works, kid. So, okay. But I have it all in a safety deposit box. And I went there about 2 years ago to make sure it was still there. The bank is like, you know, you have a safety deposit box here for like 40 years. Yeah, I know. We have to come and open it and, you know, make sure that it's used. I go, let me see what's in it. It was all still there. Because you never know. I'm always worried about, I don't think about this, but that stuff's worth a fortune. Yeah. Not that you would do anything when I'm like, I'm going to go look. I remember I got up early. When's the bank open? I went over there and it was still in there intact. It's fun, though, to have it because it's part of it. That's why I found if. A fucking Maxwell, remember, is it live? A Maxwell cassette tape, Rocky III/demo, in the safe. So I left it there. I said, this is better in this bank than. Wow. I just said, if you guys are ever going to bulldoze the bank or sell it, just let me know so I can come get it. No, we can't do that. There's laws. I said, well, I was just kidding, but make sure that I come in and check it. But it's still there.
But that song and that movie and the combination, it's almost part of American culture. It's part of American history. It's the sort of thing that probably should end up in a museum somewhere.
I would think, I don't think like that, but I have to agree with you. Didn't it kind of just, I think it grew into all of that over the years. I was talking to his brother, you know, I'm really good friends. Frank Stallone is one of my best friends. And he's always, I don't believe you can't win the fucking Oscar with that, which maybe they're not going to give. You know how that Academy is. They're not going to give it to a rock and roll band. But all these years later, the song that won, nobody ever hears it.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a point to that. I remember Sly Stone telling me, yeah, they fucked us, man. After what I saw him at the after party. But I never looked at it that way. I just. You just got to enjoy the ride because you're not going to get like that many of those rides. If one, I'll take the one. And we had a couple, but that's kind of a fun story. It's a good start.
Fantastic start. And then just moving on, obviously that was Rocky III. Rocky IV came along. So did Sly come to you straight away? Was it like, guys, I need another one?
Well, he came to the Scotty Brothers. He wants a song. And then we came up, but it was called... The Unmistakable Fire, and then Sly hated this. He hated the fucking title. You know, and the Burning Heart, The Unmistakable Fire. So, you know, Burning Heart was, but the title was Unmistakable Fire. And I could see that. I go, that title sucks. So Sly's like, the title fucking sucks. They got to change it. So then Tony Scotti goes, you guys have to go up to Stallone's office on the lot. And we went up there, like, that title's got to go. So, okay, we'll just call it Burning Heart because it's part of it. And it needs something in the chorus. Excuse me. What do you mean? He goes, I don't know, like what? Oh, like a whip. Jim and I sit around looking at each other. What do you mean? He goes, like an explosion. I said, like a whip. So we had Peter Wolf, the keyboard guy that went on to like work on the rest of our records on keyboards. The guy was in Zappa.
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking great. He did fucking unbelievable talent. Great producer. We had him come in with his Sinclair that's one press of the key. Sent it in and Fly goes, yeah, that'll work. And that was Burning Heart Story. And then that went to number two, which is kind of nice too.
Was there ever, was there ever any, because obviously Eye of the Tiger was a worldwide hit and you ran it really quickly. Was there any pressure, did you feel, to come up with something that was going to stand up to that song? Because let's be honest, it's always going to get compared, wasn't it? So did you feel any pressure in writing Burning Heart?
There might have been, but if there was, I didn't fucking care. I didn't pay it. I don't remember it. I don't think so, because we're in the middle of doing like the Vital Signs tour. Yeah. We're on the road, which lasted 22 months. That's a lot, which was a fucking blast. And it was like we had to fly in out of town to do the song. It fit in perfectly to like the lifestyle back then. So you're on the road nonstop. You're doing four shows with Jimmy Jameson, five shows a week. The fucking guy is amazing. And then you'd have a few days off. So you'd come out here and cut the track. You'd come out here and work on the track. It all just worked almost kind of seamlessly. Now that I think about it, it's kind of another blessing with time. You know, it just kind of moved naturally. Like we didn't have to force it. We didn't have to cancel dates. We didn't have, oh, this needs to get done now. So I guess there wasn't any pressure to it. We just did what we did. And he liked it. Then I said to him one time, you know, that song, it's really good. What? No Easy Way Out, man. That should be the lead song. Be quiet. I hear the guys getting all mad at me. You remember that Robert Tepper song that's in that montage in Rocky IV? Yeah. Did you ever, that's a killer track, man. Especially in that film. And, you know, me, I have to see both all the worlds at once. I'm like, that should be the lead track. And they're all like, shut up, throwing stuff at me. And, well, because I felt it should be. Now, if you watch it, go watch it. You'll see. Yeah, it's really good. And that's where he cut the montage when he's driving the car. That was a great track. So I'm like, well, we got past that one. What do you mean? Because if it were me, if I was in a collider, I'd say, you guys going to have a great cut. It's going to be hit. But track one's going to be that Robert Tepper, No Easy Way Out. And then they're like, you got to fucking shut up. Well, the other side of my brain could actually see where that would be huge. So, and he was on Scotty's too. So there, we got a little bit lucky there. We did, because they could have said, push this one.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was because it was a follow-up with the Rocky thing, the Tiger. There's a lot of really good. The whole thing is great. I just remember that moment going, when I heard Tepper, I'm like, man, that should be the fucking lead track. Fucking shut up, man. Are you kidding me? I ruined everything. Well, wait a minute. I don't want to ruin anything, but it's really good, man. Don't say that. You know how things get.
Yeah.
Well, that's me. I kind of have this weird, I have left and right of my brain. And one side can see a different picture. Even if it, like you might say, I wouldn't put it this way. Even if it doesn't work to my benefit, whatever that means, I guess a song, the finance, I can always see, well, that's a producer. I mean, I think that might work better, but that's kind of, when you're in a band, you got to be really careful what you fucking say. Because 6 months later, you're like in, you're in Germany somewhere and you're doing 20 shows and the guy's mad at you. You wanted to fucking put Robert Tepper's song in. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. You know, I just wanted to peace all the time. That was my job. I'll be the peace. By the way, don't ever take that job on.
That's
the Burning Heart, but he let us alone, man. He just wanted to whip in it. He let us alone. I give people a lot of credit, because I think that people in Sylvester Stallone's position can do a lot. And then you would get the meddler types that would just meddle and ruin everything. doctor. He just let us alone. And now I think about it in this moment, probably because he wanted people to fucking leave him alone in the beginning when they said, you can't act, you got droopy eyes. You remember that whole story?
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I just thought of that. Maybe I should say one time, hey, man, yeah, I went through the same shit. So I said, I'll just leave everybody the fuck alone. Could be. You don't know, but it could be.
Absolutely. And just mixing timelines slightly, you mentioning Jimmy Jameson and going back to Dave Bickler, because obviously he had medical issues after Caught in the Game album came out, and obviously issues with his throat and things like that. He left.
Oh, Jimmy. Dave did.
Dave did, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so but what was the decision in terms of him leaving the band? Was it a management thing? Was it you guys? Was it him?
Do you want me to be like brutally honest with you? Because I could do that.
Go for it.
I had absolutely no hesitation, no problem, no, well, let me think about it, with replacing Dave. None. You want me to tell you why? In my opinion?
Mm-hmm.
I don't give a fuck. All you friends and lovers and haters and all that shit out there. He wasn't the front man we needed. That's important. Don't forget at the time you had my friend Lou Gramm out there. You had Steve Perry. You got to have a fucking front man. Dave wasn't a front man. He was not. And then two, you have to have endurance to do that job. You know, talk to Steve Perry sometimes about it. Look at what Bruce Springsteen just went through. It's hard. I'm like, Bruce, you can't do 3-hour shows when you're like 7 years old. I love him, but Dave never had the endurance to do that. It's hard. Fucking when I used to go see Journey, because, you know, Steve Perry, I like him, and he had a really great attitude. And he had that whole lead singer thing where, like, because he just wanted to be the singer and he became the star, the rest of the guys hated him. And, man, usual story. I'm like, you know, that's how it's going to be. Told Jameson, these guys are going to hate you in a year, but don't pay attention to it. But I was relieved. I was really happy. And for a few weeks, we didn't have a singer. I was like, I don't care. It was better. I felt innately, I don't know why, I don't know what the fuck it was, but I felt like this is better than what we had going on, because what we had going on was dark. There's a lot of drugs involved, and I'm not a drug guy, and I don't, whatever, to each his own. There's a lot of fucking conniving, and it was dark. And I just said, this is bullshit. We need a guy that could fucking, a good looking guy that can sing the shit out of our songs that we write. And I look around, I go like Steve Perry and Lou Gramm, you know, these guys are fucking great. It's hard to find someone. Jimmy came in. By the way, then he has to be the first guy we audition. And the first guy, and I'm like, this is fucking, here's my brain. This is fucking unbelievable. We were rehearsing in a carpet, the part of a carpet warehouse, to be owned in Chicago. And he comes in, he's the first guy. It's Jameson. I'm like, this can't be fucking real. Then they're like, we should try other people. Like, I'm like, what? I don't give a fuck if they want it. So we did for like a week and a half or 2 weeks. And I kept going. So I told the road crew, my brother was on the road crew, a friend of mine from that I'd known since freshman year. And I'm like, man, we're going to fuck get. So one day, it was a Friday, I finally got, and I didn't get this. I got pissed off. I said, you guys, what? Fuck you. You could either get the guy from Memphis back or then look for another guitar player too. That's how strong I felt about Jameson. And in the meantime, the other guys don't know that I like to keep like really smart people like Ron Nevison. He's a fucking genius, man. It's a hard job to produce records. I sent him cassette tapes at rehearsal of like High on You, Broken Promises. What do you think of the guy? The guy sounds fucking great. What's he like? I said, he's a great guy. Why aren't the... So I finally said, look, we either get the guy back from Memphis or look for another guitar player, because this is going to go on forever. Ron said he'll do the record, but he's at the same time, Ron back then, like Foreigner, everybody wanted him. He's telling me on the phone, I have other projects to do. And that's kind of scary because he did. So we got him back and he came in. And I found out that the road crew never let him leave town. My brother Kevin and Rick, the tour manager. No, he stayed in Chicago this whole time in a hotel, and he went out drinking, having a good time, eating dinner stuff with the crew. until we fucking got our brains, our heads out of our butt and said, where is this guy? And they said, you're lucky because we've kept him in town. I was like, my heart went, oh God, thank God. He was fucking Jimmy, man. Badass. He's a badass, man. He was so fucking good. And he changed. I think at that time, man, as much as they loved us, I think we're on the brink of the Scotti brothers cutting us loose. I do. They changed distributors from Atlantic and they went to Columbia. They went to Epic, which was a great label at the time. And I think they're looking at us going, these fucking guys better do something. We'll just drop them. Because, you know, after Tiger, the next record didn't really do that good. And the next one didn't. And then I had this idea. When we got Jameson, I had this idea and it worked out. Ron. You know, Ron did our first record, okay? Do you know that story about Ron? He fucking quit because they kept bothering him every day. I'm like, and here's me. I'm a guitar player. So he did UFO. He did, you know, Michael Schenker. He did Bad Company, Mick Ross. He did Zeppelin, Jimmy Page, Pete Townsend. I'm like, I think he's really good. I know you guys are older than me, but maybe you're dumber too. I didn't know. I didn't want to say it, but I'm like, we should just go with him. Okay, so we get Ron, and all they did was fuck with the guy. Because he's like, no, that's not how you do it. And so about 8 months, I swear to God, that first record, probably $700,000 out the window. That's a lot of money in 19. Yeah. Well, John Collado was prepared to spend it. And then I still have the notes, like, where they sent Ron when he needed to correct it. He looked at it, he said, fuck it, I quit. And that almost broke my heart. So, because if you go back, I have like Somewhere in America, the way Ron wrote it, I'm playing slide guitar. I should put it out someday just to say, look at you guys, what could have had. It's fucking way better. So we get Jimmy to band, Ron looks great. I'll do it. So I said, Ron, at the time he was having a bit of a thing, in which he was coming out of, he was living up in Sausalito, the record plant up in, you know where Sausalito is, and working out of there because he's always good friends with Chris Stone. And we got Ron because at the time people were looking at him like, no, he's got a thing going on. And our manager, John Barrick, who should get so much credit that he never fucking, people don't mention the name, he went to bat with the head of, Walter Yetnikoff was a heavyweight. He's the head of Columbia. He said, no, this is who they want to use. I'm not using them to draw it. No, no. Okay, so here. If you don't want to use it, you're not only not going to get a follow-up to Tiger and all that, but he had REO. He goes, I'm not giving you a follow-up to High Infidelity. That's heavy. Well, if you're at Columbia, okay, use them. And I won't tell you what we paid Ron, but it was a song and a dance compared to his normal fee. I never saw him or any other producer. And with Ron, he's also, he doesn't use engineers because he's too good. He's a fucking killer engineer. He built the Stones mobile unit. I mean, this guy's, you look it up sometimes. So with Ron, you get the engineering. I've never seen anyone, much less Ron, work that hard. And he's fucking smart, man. He hears all this stuff in his head. So when you're putting parts down, I never saw anyone work so hard. And then Vital Signs came out with Jimmy. Yeah. I remember going, thank God. I was walking through this. This is, was kind of like my crowning moment where I said, and I don't mean this like, I said, okay, so I was right. But I just said, no, this is good. I was going to Epic and it wasn't out yet, but the Epic people had heard the record and we finished the video stuff. Every desk I went past that there was a chick sitting at, like even like hot chicks. She's Frankie, hey, what are you doing? We love your new fucking singer, man. We got to meet him. Oh, I get to the next desk. Hey, man, Frankie, that singer's gorgeous. All these chicks. So I got back to, it was Larry Stessel. He was like head of promotion. I got him in his office. I said, can I use your phone? I call up John, our manager, John. John, I think we might have a hit record out of my hand. He's laughing. Oh, you think so? Did it happen to you too? I said, every desk that had a chick. I said, and the one with the guys like, the fucking singer's great. So it was a moment. And not that I needed it, but I don't know why it would, I don't know why there would be anything other than good stuff about the Jimmy Jameson story. We're lucky. We were lucky they kept him in town. He tries off first. We'll just say, fine, it's his God, whatever you want to call it. We're done. First guy and get on with it. But you got to go to bands. Bands, let's spend 2 weeks looking for. We got the, you know, Kevin, we got this Kevin Chalfant guy, and I never knew him. One of Jim's friends, I said, that's enough. What? When we start trying out fucking friends that are nowhere near good enough, as much less as good as Jimmy Jameson, then I'm done. It was a whole thing. I'm like, can we just fucking get on with it? And then we got on with Vital Signs. And Jimmy became a star in about a week.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
And he said to me in Tokyo, man, he was a fucking great guy, man. He's fucking, the guy was, man, he had that slang. Elvis, he sounded just like Elvis, but man, what? He was right, man. What are you talking about? They all hate me. I said, they always hate the fucking singer because when he's great, he's the fucking star. They can't deal with that. Just fuck him. So he finally stopped doing it and just did his thing. You know, I said, how do you know about that? I said, well, people like Steve Perry would tell you. He told me. He has to leave the band because they hate him. Why? Because he's so fucking good. I don't know what the answer to is. Is it a jealous thing? I said, I think that'd be putting it lightly. It's a whole thing, and I don't even know how to explain it. But when a guy has to leave a band because he can't stand because he's so good, the band's fucked up. No offense to anybody. I always say friends and lovers and haters and whatever it is, but it's a true story. Jimmy was really good, man. I'm telling you, then maybe he sang a track twice at the most.
Wow.
Ron would say, or when I'd work with him myself, like Man Against the World, ever since the war began, I swear, one take, and I said, just sing your second verse. And it's so good, we get to do the record. Even Ron goes, Ron, I hear, he goes, well, what do you want me to do with this? I said, maybe. He goes, didn't I teach you enough? He goes, listen to it. I said, but it's my Lynn drum machine. What the fuck about the drums, man? Listen to the fucking lyrics, the way this guy sings. And Jimmy had great clarity. So you could, this is a gift too. You could understand every single word he sang. I told Jim one time, we're looking a gift horse in the mouth, because if you want to be a prick about it, he's a songwriter's dream. You can understand every word. Whereas with Dave, you got to go, what's that word? You know, Jimmy was just special guy, man. Amazing guy. Amazing guy. He just got into some stuff that wasn't all that good for him. That's all. Which happens. It happens, man. But I fucking miss him, man. He's fucking great.
Yeah.
I was lucky to be in a band with him. He's every bit as good as Steve Perry. And that says everything you need to know, because I'm a huge Steve Perry fan. And always, including a story about the fucking band hates me, the whole thing, I get the whole thing. Probably a curse of mine. I'm like, why do I always hate the fucking singer? Of course, if he's great, he's going to be the star, but that means like you're going to do better. Bands are really weird, man. You have to know that. It's just weird enough to come on your show and cop to it. That's all. Pete Townsend would. Then they get over it. See, when they get, as time goes on, they get over that shit.
That's true. And talking about time going on and getting over things, I mean, a bit later on, obviously, reunion tours and things like that, you got Dave and Jimmy together, didn't you, with the band? So how did all that come about? Whose idea was it? And did you have to talk anyone into it, or was everyone on board from the start?
It was my idea, but I don't think it was one of my better ideas. I don't know what, I think, I just loved to play the hits live to this fans and audience. And I just thought, if you had both of them, you could really do everything. You know, so, and if you think about the purity of that thought, it's a really good thought. But the reality is always, you must know about reality. You don't have to be mean. Reality can differ with what we think sometimes. It never really worked because the differences, and they got on really good, but the differences between those two guys, that wasn't very healthy for Dave. That was not good for him to be in with Jimmy. And that's just, it's a hard gig, man. The fucking guys, he's a hard act to follow. When you're playing a show, man, and you look over and Steve Perry comes to your fucking show, your singer's a fucking great singer. Okay, or he don't come to shows all the time. He said to me one time, Steve Perry goes to me, man, that guy, he turned sideways. He goes, the only thing he's missing that I got is this schnoz. You know, Steve Perry said, yeah, he did. Said that to me once. I said, that's a huge compliment. He goes, yeah, it is. So, you know, it was hard. It was hard for Dave because then you have a guy that's really great on the stage with the audience and audience friendly. And then Dave's kind of timid. And it put the spotlight on both of them. And one of them, it was good for. The other one, it wasn't good for. So I said, this isn't going to work. And then Jimmy always told me, just find a young guy that looks like me, man, that can sing all the fucking hits, man, because the fucking keys are getting high and stuff. I said, Jim, you sing the former. I'm just saying, man. And then we did. Then Cameron came into the picture.
Incredible
stuff. But that didn't work that good. I don't think that was healthy for Dave. I don't. Yeah. I just don't.
And just chatting about various incidents over the years with the names of the band and things like that. How's things between yourself and Jim these days? Is that a completely closed book now?
Nothing's ever. You know, when the book's closed, maybe, until someone comes back and tells me it's closed, maybe like when they bury us and they're pissing on the roses, maybe the book closed. I don't think the book's ever closed. You know, we don't talk like we should talk a lot more. We don't. I don't know why we don't. Or I do know why we don't. And I'm not positive, and I don't want to say it because 20 some years, 22 or 3 years, maybe like 1,000 songs. Jim and I wrote songs Monday through Friday, generally about 1 to 2 o'clock till after traffic, which was about 7. And it wasn't unusual that I would go on a Saturday and do a mix, or we would meet there and tweak a song and then put a vocal on. So that's a lot of years. You know, people, I didn't need to get older. Older, you like that choice of words. I didn't need to get older to figure that out. I think I knew that when I was younger, but that's a lot of fucking songs, man. And I hear these interviews when Ron did, I wrote Ron on a podcast and he's talking about, he's worked with Desmond Child, great songs. He got to us, he goes, those two fucking guys, man. Those two guys are the shit. And I'm like, Jim, are you watching this? In my head, I'm like, because I think when you spend that much time together writing stuff, and those differences are strengths. They are. Even if you're not getting on, you know, none of us always get on. It's life. But when those differences are such strong points, I don't think there's any room for the nonsense to go on. Jim just has a different. You have to remember, Jim wanted to sing Searches Over on the record. And I told him he was out of his mind, so that probably didn't go over good. Well, we got this guy. The song was number one for a month. I think that I was right. And he should tell it. So then he would start. There would be bad moments with Ron, bad vibes. And Ron going to him and Ron say, don't fucking say it. Don't say it. He taught me, let people speak for themselves. But Jim wants to sing Search. Okay, take him fucking home so I can do the vocal, because Ron has no patience for that stuff. And he goes, and you know I'm right. So I think that maybe, I don't know, I'll be that honest, because what's the worst I could be is wrong. I think maybe that Jim might have some attitudes about that. Or like being the guitar player. I didn't say it one day. Ron said one day, you know, I worked with Michael Schenker. I was doubling some guitar parts. He said, he could be the only guy that doubles guitar parts as good as Michael Schenker. And then I'm like, did he just fucking say that? Because he's a fucking killer guitar player. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so, but Jim wants to play guitar. He's like, you hire me to do this. It sounds better when you double the part. Well, that's the producer's job. So get mad at him. And I'd say, but you could tell him. So then I'd be the mouthpiece. Ron, he'd say, look, man, you got to stop talking for other people. And one day I said the other day, you know what the worst thing could be in life? And I said, I don't even know if it's worse. Don't ever be the leader of a fucking band. Just don't do it. I said that on some interview. I said, just your stomach will be a lot better if you're not like the proxy leader of the band. And everybody else wants to project your leader because you become this peacemaker and you can't make peace with that stuff because someone has to make a decision. So when you hire the producers and it searches over, this is like a great song. It was number one for a month. It was the third single. It was the video. The video was number one, too, out for a month on MTV. And he's like, but I could sing the song. I'm like, no, 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 no. And then later I was like, you know, I could have sang that song. Dude, the fucking song was number. The video, did you see him? Do you see our audience, how it's changed? The video is number one for a month. They love the guy, but I could have sang the song. You just have to go, fuck it. You don't want to hear it anymore. So there could be that rub in there. And then the guitar thing that was really Ron's. Ron did what he wanted to. That when you hire someone of Ron's caliber, and he would argue with Paul Rogers too, he would argue with Jimmy Page, he would argue with the Stones, but when you hire someone of Ron's caliber, then you have to be able to accept when he goes, you know, I'm going to tell you about certain songs. You cannot polish a turd. You can't get mad at him. You got to just say the song sucks. So the next two records, you can't bring in the same song. What about this song? Because he's going to go, we dealt with that two records ago. They get a little bit aggravated like you would.
Understandable, anybody would. Yeah.
But Jim did a lot of that. He caused a lot of tensions with that. I would say this song, Cried a Wild Heart, it was three records. So finally Ron says, okay, I'm going to say we're going to cut the song. So Mark cuts it off. I want everybody to just put their instrument down and walk out of the room. I'm like, I can't do that. Why? Because I know what it's going to do to Jim. But maybe it'll help him. And I kind of went along with it. I did not like doing that at all. I didn't think that was a good call because at a point you just say, but then Ron would say, but it's three records later. So certain things like that, I just wished, not wished. I think at the time it would have been a different way that for all of us, but Jim could have looked at it. And, you know, you hire Jameson, we write this song, Search Is Over. And then, well, I want to sing it. I don't think that, let's run it past Ron. But you should tell Ron I could, no, he yells at me. Because he says, look, if you want to do this, in which I did produce records, you got to fucking learn. No. So maybe there's some of that involved, you know. And then Search Is Over, the second verse, we would often, as we write a song, so you want to get the cadence down and you just say, I'm going to write a dummy verse, you know. Can we last forever? Will we fall apart? It's at times, it's so confusing. These questions of the heart. Okay, we left town. And Ron had the lyrics, and they sang it with the dummy verse. Well, my phone rang. It gave me such a hassle with that thing. When it was number one, I called him every fucking week when we found out. That second verse really killed the fucking song, didn't it? That's how much I got driven nuts with it. So I don't know if I had this mixed blessing memo to see it all. And I never knew, well, maybe Jim's making a point, but then I would defer to the to Ron. But then you get, well, you and Ron are closer. So you have fans, man. You got to just say, fuck. It's like walking a minefield. Yeah. You're going to go, well, when I do this, it's going to be right, but that's going to blow up. And then, so then you just say to Ron, one day Ron said to me, let me tell you something. Man. I remember this. You pay me an awful lot of fucking money to be a buffer. And I said to him, and you're worth every cent of it. So there's a lot of that goes on. And I don't know, maybe bands don't talk about them enough. I can't speak for other bands, but we didn't. When we would try, it would be more resistance or on everybody's part. I'm not excluded. And I just thought that whole thing could have, not should have, could have been avoided. All of it. All of it. I just think the whole thing, we should have left it alone after we got Jim and Jameson in the band and just continued on. And if somebody, I told Jim one time, if you don't want to do dates, you and I can just write the fucking songs and then go hire two other keyboard players and it won't matter and you don't have to go on the road. And that was offensive. And I said, but you just told me you don't want to be on the road. So I tried to come up with all these, I would always go, honest to God, I always go there and try to come up with some kind of like, okay, this would be healthy. What you and I, we could still write all these fucking songs because I love all that, man. No, I loved it. I don't have to be the guy either. That's a fucking bad trip. And I said to him, and we could still write, and then you don't have to come on the road. You just stay home and write or do whatever else you do. Are you trying to No, you're irreplaceable. That's not, you know, it just gets to a point where I think that, I'm not going to even say it's the person, but there's obstacles that are not necessary that are placed there repeatedly. One or two you could deal with, but when it's repetition, you say, okay, now I know this. It's like I'm a fisherman, a fly fisherman. I know where the fish are. I know what they're biting on. When I can sense that coming, I'm like, no. The hatch, that's the wrong bait. You know, so I kind of applied all that, and I just tried to be diplomatic, but that only works to a point. As we're seeing around the world right now, I think you just have to be decisive and take your lumps and then tell your truth and tell the authentic truth without offending people, and just be yourself and be comfortable being in your own skin. Because this business loves to yank us out of our skin, tug on our heart, tug on our soul, split our brains in half, just fuck with us and take the money. You know the business. It's everything they say about our entertainment business is true. The only difference between the music business and the movie business deals in billions. We deal in millions. But it's still the same game. So I think you just have to tell your own truth and try to live your own truth. It's hard. It's life.
Yeah, of course.
Bands. Fucking bands, man. Get the fuck over it. Just take a great. No, I'm telling you, man. It's the fucking singer. Oh, bad. They're mad at me. Come on, man. Just like Steve Perry's a fucking great singer. Just won't do it anymore. I think people get scarred. They go, I don't want to deal with it. You're like, but you're so fucking good. And then you go, yeah, bands can do that to a guy. They do that. So I love them. And I still love them. I think it's the right combination. I heard Billy Joel. I'm a big Howard Stern fan because his interviews are so fucking good. They got really good. And I heard Billy Joel on his show the other day. He was talking about, you know, Stern said to him, you should do like a Traveling Wilburys. And I'm a huge Traveling Wilburys fan because you got Petty, Harrison. Yeah, okay. And Billy Joel said, yeah, I wanted to do that. He goes, I thought about it. Me. And he goes, and maybe Paul McCartney, and he goes, and Ringo, and he goes, and then Jeff Beck, who's my ultimate fucking guitar hero, like everyone, including Clapton and Page, always. But and he goes, and then Jeff Beck died. So goes, and I'm thinking, maybe Billy Gibbons, who I love, he's fucking killer. And he goes, or maybe like a guy like John Mayer. I'm like, does anybody know how I can get a hold of Billy Joel? Because I'll go try, and then they'll say this guy could actually play or something, you know. But I think like that. So I think I'm not alone, because Billy had a killer band. You remember his band like in the 80s and 90s with Liberty DeVito? That was like the fucking Easter. And he just said they all got to be a nuisance and they thought they were. The same thing happened to him. And he's Billy Joel. So I said, call. And if I suck, just throw me out. And by the way, I told you earlier, I'm a huge fan of John Mayer. He's really good. He writes great songs. No, he does. He writes, his songs are great. He sings great. His lyrics are great. His fucking guitar playing, his acoustic guitar playing with all his tunings is killer. His lead guitar playing is great. His tones, he's the whole thing. I said to him, someone says he hangs out like the comedians, which is kind of another thing that pisses me off, because I love the comedians. That's the heart. They're more tortured than we are. They don't get a laughter done. Yeah. The whole fucking day's moon. And the comedians, and somebody said to me one time, John, I said, I got to get a hold of him. Yeah, it'll take a while. John doesn't have a lot of friends. And I said, I'll tell you why, because to whatever gen that is, we're gen and Y, whatever these fucking tags are. I said, he's the guy. What do you mean? I said, he writes those songs, the lyrics, sings. I said, and the extra thing is he gets all those hot chicks. So that's hard to make friends with those other guys his age, because they're probably going, who's he banging now? Because John gets around, man. He's bad. I'm telling you, man, he's really good. Watch him sometime.
Absolutely.
And he took Jerry Garth, then he ends up in the Dead.
Yeah.
That's fucking hard, man. Jerry was a fucking great guitar player.
And speaking of guitar players, we've got to speak about you as well, because I've seen on social media that you're recording and you've got maybe four or five songs down. Yeah. So tell us about that. What's happening?
I did it in my own. I decided, and you know, okay, I'm getting away from it. So there was a time when Epic wanted me to do this, and the band was like really pissed off. You know, when you walk in the dressing room, it gets real quiet, and you go, "Oh, these guys were talking about me," you know. And I never did it because the guys in the band would get really mad. Like if I would go off and do Eddie Money's record, or I work with John Way, or when I went through the hard stuff, the guys in the band get really mad at me. So the other day I said, I don't know if I was scarred from it, but it did something to me. So I didn't really do much on my own. And then I started about maybe 5 years ago, I said, I'm going to do my own project. And I hooked up with this guy. I'm not telling you, it was Mayall's band. He did Mabel Staples' record. This guy's badass. And all his guys, horn players, and I started doing stuff. And I called him about 3 or 4 months ago. I said, hey, dude, let's go on this thing. So today he just sent me one of the final tracks we cut. Here, horns, strings, and all. And it's fucking great. So I'm doing my own project. I'm about 5 songs into it now, which is a first. But I have to tell you, you know, when you say, why did you wait so long? I don't look at that. I waited because, and I don't really look at things this way. It's fucking really good, man. It's more me. It's my roots. Yeah, there's going to be some pop songs on it because I write them. But there's a couple old standards I cover, but I kicked them up to different notches. It's really cool. And then I got all these great players, man. They're all like brothers. You know, they play different. It's fucking great. I'm happy now, but I'm going to be really happy when we get down to the guitar parts if I start practicing again. I said to the guy I work with, I said, it's so fucking good. I hope the guitar player is good enough to play. He goes, you're so funny. I said, I don't know if it's funny, but we'll find out. But it'll be great. I think it's more, I like to be in the moment. You know, there's something about just, you're getting warmed up, but there's something about when you're not aware that they have this record button pressed and you're playing and you play it back and you go, if I fuck with that, I'll ruin it. That's more what I'm about. Like Angus. Angus is like, I played the fucking track once, man, solo and all, that's it. Isn't he? He's amazing, man. He's fucking amazing. But I'm happy with it. And I don't have a deadline, but I'd like to get out in the fall because I was telling my own manager, I want to go. And he says, it's a really good idea. I said, I want to play clubs. Well, how big? I don't know. 75. No, 75 seats. You got to pay 500. Whatever. I just want to go out and play the clubs because why? Because then I'm closer to the people at first. Well, you know, they may want you on packages and stuff. I said, I don't even want to think about that for now. I just want to take it a step at a time. So I look forward to going out and playing my own stuff for once with this great fucking band and having a great time. I look at it and I said, this is why Clapton probably had Steve Gadd in his band for like 40 years and Nate Denise on bass and Andy Fairweatherlow and Chuck. And he had Billy Preston for a while. I mean, this is why you hang on to people for all those years, because they make you a better player. So that's how I'm looking at it. But yeah, I want to get it done. And I know I'm not in a hurry, but it moves along because the person I'm working with is just a fucking genius. And he's great at it. He moves it along. He's got great vibes and soul. And then I'm looking at maybe fall playing some dates.
Wow. And you can't say fairer than that. Playing your own stuff out on the road, doing your own thing. It just sounds...
You know where I want to do it at? I want to do it across the pond, your side of the pond, because I spent... Well, in the 80s, we spent so much time there that there was a point I said, I'm going to buy a home in Germany. It's a beautiful country. Mm-hmm. It's not... Scotland's the fucking... Okay. You want to fly fish. I mean, you know, Scotland's ridiculously beautiful. And even Ireland. But I was going to look and buy a place in Germany because it's a different lifestyle.
Yeah.
I spent like a lot of Easters there or, you know, holidays. And it's kind of festive and the people are super cool.
Yeah.
When I was starving, I went to this bar in Germany. I didn't even know the town, small town. I said, I'm hungry. Anywhere I get something to eat? She said, I just made this beautiful, some roast for my family. She gave me a plate of it. It was the best fucking roast I ever ate in my life. How much is it? No, it's on the house. I've had great experiences there. So it's a little bit of a different cadence.
Yes.
I understand why people move over there. I do. And I also understand why the English guys never leave.
Yeah,
they live out in Sussex and Kensington. Well, they just move up in places, but before that, they had apartments there and they don't leave. It's a different thing. Like Mark Knopfler, he's one of my idols. He never leaves. I was going to go work at the studio at one point, and the budget was kind of like, I didn't care until I realized I'd have to bring in 12 people and stuff. But he's got that studio, British Grove. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's fucking great. He's great, by the way. He's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, he could tell you about bands. Go talk to him sometime. He was in the band. Talk to Sting, didn't they? Used to beat him up and stuff. You fucking Sting, you're famous. They like beat him up. And did you ever read that book?
Yeah, well, I spoke to Stuart Copeland. He's told me the stories, yeah.
Yeah, and he tells the truth too, Stuart, yeah. But it's hard. I just think that at the end of the day with music, if you're authentic and you do what you do best, it will resonate. If you try, it won't.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's like the story.
Absolutely. Well, Frankie, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you and hearing all your stories. Yeah. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, man. We get to see once you the guy to here. I'm the quiet guy. See, once I get going,
that's it.
I'm off to the races. But I think you know people should know some of this stuff because they've only heard a story that's really not. It's fictional, and I think the unfictional version has the heart to it, the soul to it, the vibe to it, the people involved, amazing people involved in our careers. These are fucking great people. The producers, the A&R people, they're fucking great people. The assistant engineers, like one of them, the assistant engineers, excuse me, one of them went on to do Guns N' Roses. And these are really good people, our whole career. Yeah. Well, you have to look at that and learn from it.
Absolutely. And we'll definitely have to get you back on in the fall as well when the music drops. We'll find out all about that as well.
Yeah, that's worth it. Well, I hope you edit the shit out of this fucking thing and make it. It is what it is, dude. But I tell you this, God is my witness, man. It is the gospel truth.
And that's all you all can ask for. All you can ask for. Well, Frankie, yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day. I hope you have a lovely day, and thank you so much for your time.
We'll talk again. I hope we'll talk again soon.
Definitely, definitely.
There you go, Frankie Sullivan there. I told you, didn't I? Brutally honest, completely open, and fascinating. I really, really hope you enjoyed that one. Now, I've got a lot of other big names coming your way in the next few weeks. In fact, I've done so many interviews that I'm struggling to get them all out, to be honest. I was even considering doubling up and releasing two a week for a little while. It may happen, given the interviews that I've done that are still sitting here kind of waiting for you to listen to. So, while I ever think about that, you go and check out VRP Rocks Radio. Give it a try. You won't regret it. Some brilliant music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that you won't have heard on usual classic rock radio in a long, long time. The link for the station is in the podcast description. Also, make sure you subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so you get all future episodes released each Monday, maybe more often if I get through them. And leave VRP Rocks a 5-star review on the podcast app you use. It makes a big difference, it really does. And check out VRP Rocks' YouTube channel and social media channels too. But that's it until next week's episode then. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.